Okay, so I'm seeing a lot of talk at the moment on social media about this Hogwarts Legacy game, which, for those of you who are unaware, is set in the sort of Harry Potter Hogwarts world, 100 years, I think, before Harry appeared on the scene. Obviously, there are links to J.K. Rowling because she's the writer of the Harry Potter books. Ergo, she will stand to benefit from the success of this game. And it's like, I just keep hearing about this and seeing tweet after tweet after tweet. I've seen a number of videos on it. I've just watched a couple of them in actual fact. And it's just such an interesting thing that I wanted to talk about it because it seems to crystallize so many of the ways in which things are moving. I want to talk about cancel culture in relation to it. This suggestion that cancel culture doesn't exist, or if it does exist, what is it? I'd like to discuss that, I think. I'd like to discuss allyship and why I always think it's such a really bad thing to ever admit to. Never ever call yourself an ally. So I want to talk about those things. And the question that's being asked at the moment is, will you be playing Hogwarts Legacy? What's kind of interesting is how few of those conversations revolve around actually, well, let's wait and see how good the game is. Let's wait for a few, let's do all the normal kind of stuff, you know. If it's the kind of game that I want to play, and it's good, then maybe play it. If it isn't, then maybe not. It's just become a sort of battleground, I think. There is a clear effort on the part of some people to try and encourage others to not play it. We've moved away, I think, from the way that we used to function. People always used their spending power to sort of show some sense of judgment on things. But I get the feeling that nowadays people aren't happy with that. People don't like the idea that if 50,000 people purchase something and they're one in their 50, those 50,000, that they will only have the impact of one in 50,000. Because, hey, I'm more important than that, right? My vote counts more than everybody else's. So I need to find ways that will afford me to have more impact than you would think would be justified were I to have an equal impact to everybody else. And so this is where it starts to get a bit nasty, I think. At the other end of the scale, as a result of this, it appears that it's already a fabulously successful game on pre-orders alone. So clearly there are a lot of people who are pre-ordering the game as a sort of, well, either a sign of allegiance to J.K. Rowling. And as many of you will know, J.K. Rowling has made a series of statements, and other statements have been attributed to her, such that some people regard her as transphobic and other people have her back, let's say. Either don't regard her as transphobic or, well, you can call her whatever you like, but we side with her. I'm not going to make a judgment on that particular thing. I think. Do you know what? This is a little bit of an aside from this video, but this video is going to be a little bit rambling anyway. But I think far too much attention is paid. I've always thought this, regardless of whatever subject it's been involved in, feminism, atheism, whatever it is, far too much attention is paid as to whether a label can be applied to somebody than what they've actually said, what their views actually are. And especially when it comes to these sort of auto-dismiss labels, you know, Marxist, Nazi, transphobe, bigot, these sort of auto-win labels that so much seems to be applied to applying the auto-win label rather than actually having the argument. And this very much seems to be the case with J.K. Rowling, I think. But people are clearly aligning on both sides, and like pre-ordering a game gains you very little, other than the fact you might have pre-ordered a game that actually wasn't very good. I did it with No Man's Sky and regretted it. I've never done it since, albeit that game has significantly improved since its launch. There are two reasons why people might be doing it with J.K. Rowling. One is because they side with them. The other is because they maybe have a little bit of the mindset that I have, which is if somebody starts looking at you and saying, I'm going to look down on you if you do this thing, I'm going to try and pressure you socially not to do it, I get a real urge to want to do it. At that point, even if it's something I didn't really want to do, if it's something I didn't want to vote for or something I didn't want to go along with, I have to fight the urge to do it just to sort of stick that middle finger up at the people that are trying to coerce me into doing it. I haven't done it in this case because I just think that's a bad thing to do. I will choose to play the game based on whether I think it's a game that I'll enjoy and whether I think the game is good enough. But I want to talk about three things: cancel culture and allyship. But before I do, I just want to say I'm not really sure. Yes, I am sure. I was going to say I'm not really sure what the motivations of the boycott the game crowd are. But I think I do know what the motivations of the crowd are, because it's not the stated motivations, because the stated motivations don't really make sense, so they kind of flip between them. One of them is that J.K. Rowling is going to financially profit from the game. I just went to check before starting recording. It's estimated she's worth about $1 billion, about just over £800 million. I don't know how much more transphobing she could do with the kind of money that this game could generate for her is the kind of money which for somebody like me and my family would be life-changing. But for J.K. Rowling, it's a drop in the ocean. So even if you regard her, whatever you regard her as having done or capable of doing, I don't know what you think this extra drop in the ocean is. What difference is it going to make to her or to anything? So that doesn't really make any sense. There are people who say, "Oh, well, yeah, it's not about the money; it's about the impact or the fact that." It shows that that a work sort of effectively the popularity of a work is suggesting that in some ways we're condoning her views, and yet at the same time, these people and others are saying, "But if you are going to play the game, pirate it." Well, so which is it? If you think pirating is going to make some difference, then it is about the money, isn't it? It's not about the fact that this piece of social currency, which is the Harry Potter franchise, which she is associated with, is going to get a little boost in sort of public perceptions yet again. What I actually think is it's none of these things. It's something that's much more old-fashioned than these than what is trying to dress it up to be. It's vengeance is what drives this. It's vengeance. If you don't like J.K. Rowling, and there are some people who really don't like J.K. Rowling, then what you want is some vengeance. And if you could make this game, which would be the sort of crown jewel, it's thought within that sphere of her franchise, an abject failure because nobody buys it, because people boycott it, because it's associated more with the boycott than the qualities of the game and the wizarding world of Harry Potter, then that would be a success. That's a knife in her side. It's vengeance that drives stuff like this. I've always been somebody that says I don't really have a problem with vengeance. I got into some debates maybe 10 years ago on YouTube, where people were talking about prisons and the way that prisons should all be about keeping people out of the system so they can't harm others, and about allowing them to redevelop and so they can come back in society and be useful citizens. And I agreed with all of that, but I said, for me, there's also an element of vengeance, right? I want to see you punished. I want to get a little bit of retribution on somebody when they're sent to prison. That's part of it for me. And they very much looked down on me, my interlocutors there, for having that attitude. But I think that's a perfectly normal human attitude that for some reason we sort of don't like to really show anymore. Listen, the reason that I really wanted to make this video was because I wanted to link it to cancel culture and allyship. Let's talk about cancel culture first, because it kind of really frustrates me. You hear so many conversations about cancel culture and people saying there's no such thing as cancel culture. It doesn't exist. What is it then? You know, show me somebody who's been cancelled. Jordan Peterson doesn't seem to have been cancelled exactly, does he? So that disproves that there is such a thing. It's a really odd way of looking at things. The people who make that argument are often the same kind of people who would happily talk about something like rape culture and don't base the entire premise on the idea that somebody has to successfully rape somebody else for their actions to be driven by something that we could call rape culture, right? So why does cancel culture, why does everything have to hinge on its success? And in terms of its success, we have a very unrepresentative sample, do we not? Because the people who are successfully cancelled are the people that we don't hear very much about. The people who we hear quite a lot about are the people who managed to, in one way or another, to fight against it, right? They work out the winners because it becomes a big media splash. And then there's either some kind of retraction or there isn't a retraction, but the people who are so much against that or who like what they have to say start funding them. That's the case with Jordan Peterson, isn't it? Which is that effectively he started making money not being a clinical psychologist than he was as a clinical psychologist. So it wasn't that somebody wasn't trying or a group weren't trying to cancel him, weren't trying to get him struck off as a clinical psychologist, thrown out of the university that he lectured at. It's that he's managed to make more success in another sphere. But it's a very selective group that we're looking at here. The people that we see are the people who we make it in that social media sphere. Instead, it doesn't always work out that way. There was a case very recently, which again did come into the social media, but quite clearly if it didn't, it wouldn't have worked out that way. At a place called, I think, it's either Hamlin or Hamline University in the United States. And this woman was teaching a history of art course about Islamic art and the history of Islamic art. And a significant chunk of the history of Islamic art include some artists who back in the day drew Muhammad. Yes, they did. They actually represented the Prophet Muhammad in their art. And so that needed to be part of a course. Any reasonable, rational person can see that, right? And so she needed to show the students some pictures of that, right? Now, what happened was, I mean, she fell over herself. When you read about it, she fell over herself to try and to try and make sure that no students were upset. She let them know what these pictures are going to be shown. You are going to see representations of the Prophet Muhammad. If you don't want to see these pictures, you can turn your display off. You don't have to view them. I mean, it's kind of pathetic, really, isn't it? I mean, when I joined the fire service, we saw pictures of people mangled and burnt and all kinds of things to show you these scenarios, right? I mean, come off it. It's a several century old picture, painting of... It could be anybody from that part of the world, right? But somebody's going, nah, that's supposed to be Muhammad, right? And that's so offensive to you, right? I mean, grow up, for Christ's sake. You're on a history of art course, is what I would say. But a complaint was made, even with the warnings, even with the get out, you don't have to view the pictures. And of course, the person who complained was like the person, it was the student who was the head of the Muslim Students Association. Because I always think the people who are the head of these organisations of universities ought to have a badge on them saying, warning, shit stirrer, right? Warning, I am trouble. Because almost to an individual, they are trouble. You know, those of you who can remember Essence of Thought, it will come as no surprise to you that when they were at university, they were head of whatever it was, the secular society of their university, or the free speech society, whichever one it was, right? That's the kind of person who leads these things. They're almost, to an individual, a shit stirrer, a troublemaker. They're looking to create this kind of disharmony. They're looking for something to be offended by. And they complained about it. And the university, I mean, their response was absolutely ridiculous. They not only said that the lecturer, right, that they're never coming back, they're never lecturing here again, but they accused them of being Islamophobic for showing these pictures. That's what they said. It's Islamophobic to show these images. And then they doubled down on it, which would be quadrupled down on it, I think. Doubled down on it again. And they were making statements like, public statements like, we believe that free speech is important, but it can never be at the expense of students taking offence, right? Like, if you honestly believe that, then the first part of the sentence, we think free speech is important, it just strike it off. Because you don't believe that. Because there is always a student who's going to take offence. There's virtually nothing you can say where somebody isn't going to take offence. Now, let's read between the lines, right? Because you know as well as I do that university has a sort of priority list of whose offence they care about and whose offence they'd actually laugh about, right? There will be some students, some people with some opinions that aren't their opinions, that they're not very sensitive to, where if they were to take offence, they'd actually be sniggering at the fact that they were offended, right? They don't mean it. What they mean is that free speech can't trump the offence of people that we give a shit about. That's what they really mean. But you're always going to offend. Even then, there's always somebody who's desperate to be offended and will be offended by whatever they've seen. So, no. No, in those circumstances, you don't care about free speech. Actually, if you think that it's always got to be secondary to somebody taking offence, then it's always secondary. Then its worth is zero, quite frankly, because there's always somebody that will take offence. But eventually, there was so much pushback, including by Islamic scholars, professors, who are Muslims themselves, who were saying, this is just crazy. This isn't Islamophobic to show these images. This is part of the history of Islamic art. True, we wouldn't paint these pictures today, but if you're studying Islamic art, this is just a ridiculous response. And eventually, the university backed down. And then it's, oh yes, we've made a terrible misstep. I mean, like, how many missteps did they had a week of, like, four or five, like, everybody from their head office was talking about and making misstep after misstep. But then all of a sudden, whoopsie, we seem to have made a mistake there. And obviously these things we've been saying for the past week and a half, we didn't really mean any of them. It's brilliant. That's how it works. So cancel culture failed. That student, that head of the Islamic Student Society or whatever it was, she failed in what she did. What she wanted to do, what she was trying to do effectively, was to say, I am one student amongst many, but I'm more important than the other students. I don't want to see these images, ergo, nobody should see them. Even if you're not a Muslim student, you shouldn't be allowed to see them because I'm more important than everybody else. My sense of self-worth is so great that I think that what I want to be the case has to trump everybody else. And so I am prepared to go to the extent of trying to get this teacher, this lecturer, thrown off campus permanently. They'll never get any more work on the campus to achieve that. It didn't work, but it only didn't work because it became a national thing. How many times does it not become a national thing? Why does cancel culture have to depend on being successful? An example that I draw back to with this whole trans thing was when in the UK a lot of the sports women were coming out and talking about it. Martina Navratilova was talking about it. Who else was talking about it? Sharon Davis, the swimmer. She's been talking about it ever since. But I think it was Dame Kelly Holmes, the middle distance runner, of course, won a gold in the 800 metres and maybe the 1500 metres as well. Back in 2012, maybe, London Olympics. And she still has some sponsors. And she made, I think, one or two tweets just saying, yeah, I think there's an issue that needs to be looked into here, right? We need to look at the policies. And her sponsors were contacted. People were contacting her sponsors to try and get her sponsorships removed. That's what cancel culture means, trying to undermine people. It's not just voting with your own unit and saying, yeah, I'm just not going to support Kelly Holmes anymore. It's trying to go down the line and undermine them, trying to stop them earning a living, trying to stop them having just reasonable, normal avenues of exchange of views. I watched on this very subject yesterday, I think, Destiny, the streamer, talking about this Harry Potter business. And he was talking about when, in his view, he was cancelled. Let's put that term to one side for a minute. You can decide for yourself. But what happened was, he was accused of being racist. That was the implication. And some people decided they weren't going to view his streams anymore. So they stopped viewing his streams. But you can imagine a few people, however many it is, 100, 1,000 stopped viewing his streams. It's a drop in the ocean. But like I say, the mindset people have is, well, I'm more important than just counting as one person. And so this hasn't had a sufficient impact. The impact doesn't merit my importance. So what do? They went after his sponsors. And they tried to get his sponsors to withdraw their sponsorship. In other words, let's undermine him. Let's undercut his ability to earn. Because he has some views, or they believed he had some views, which they didn't agree with. And it didn't work, according to him. The sponsors rebuffed him and said, we're not going to, you know, succumb to this, go away. And so do you know what these people did? They went after the clients of his sponsors to try and encourage the clients of his sponsors to pressurize the sponsors to drop him. Now if was it successful? No. But does the fact that it wasn't successful mean that cancel culture doesn't exist? The culture element. If you remember the definition of rape culture is something like, it's a culture where the attitudes to rape are normalised. There's a permissive attitude to rape. It's not seen as such a bad thing, blah, blah, blah. And that rape is prevalent. Okay. So it's attitudes, normalisation of positive attitudes towards and prevalence. I think the same thing would apply here then. That's what we're talking about with culture. We could say with gun culture, attitudes towards guns, positive attitudes are normalised. It's a culture where people look at guns quite positively, the people within that culture, and they tend to have a higher level of guns. You could talk about it with crime culture, drugs culture, any of those things, a normalisation of attitudes, positive attitudes towards, and the prevalence. So have we got a normalisation of positive attitudes? Absolutely you have, because you have the people saying this is a legit thing to do. Go after them. Go after their sponsors. People team up and do it as a group. So how is that not a culture? How is that part of the equation not there, right? When you have people actually doing it. I've heard people on YouTube poo-poo cancel culture as an idea when these very things have happened to their own channels. People have gotten together and seen it as legitimate to try and flag their channels down as a group. How is that not a normalization of attitudes towards thinking that that is a legitimate behavior? Is it not prevalent? Yeah, a lot of this is happening. It just seems to be that, like the sort of modus operandi. If you're a famous person who's sponsored, who has advertising, has any of these relationships, if you say something that's controversial, people will go straight to your advertisers and try and coerce them into dropping you as a client to try and end their relationship with you. It doesn't always work. But for cancel culture to be a thing, I don't think the, well, it has to work bit, that's just bollocks, quite frankly. We wouldn't have that as a, we wouldn't have that as a requirement for any other kind of culture, that it works. Drugs culture, gun culture, rape culture, crime culture, that it has to be successful, otherwise it's not a culture. The thing is that people want to do these things, they see it as an acceptable way of carrying on, and they try and do it. And I'm damn sure that cancel culture is effective. We know of examples where people have lost their reputations, where people have lost their jobs, where people have lost posts at universities. So to say that it's never successful, the fact that some of these people become famous online and manage to make money in other ways, in no way negates it. In no way undermines the idea, falsifies it. All it means is that sometimes it backfires. Sometimes it doesn't work the way the perpetrators intend. And actually, the people that they're trying to deny a voice to, because that particular case blows up in the media, end up with an even larger voice than they started off with. The last thing I wanted to talk about, and I know this is a little bit rambly today, but that's all it is. It's just talking about this. Getting it off my chest, a chance for people to leave comments and respond, even leave a video in response if you wish to. If that's the way that you do things, if you have a channel, is the business of allyship. I'm going to read you a comment here. This was the comment that made me make this video. It was the like comments thread. Activists are calling us transphobes for buying Harry Potter. I'm not a bad person. I want to play a wizard game. That was a sort of quote that they were going to respond to. Buying HP stuff doesn't make you a transphobe. What it is saying is that you care more for entertainment than trans people. It says you're not an ally. Okay, well, first let's just deal with the bit that I dealt with on Twitter that I couldn't help respond to. It doesn't show that you care more about entertainment than trans people. That's just a really weird way of framing something. It's like suggesting if somebody uses a polythene bag on one occasion that it means that they care more for convenience than they do for the death of the planet. Right. I mean, things are a little bit more complicated than that, aren't they? Sure, if you buying that Harry Potter game meant all trans people would immediately die, then yeah, you're right there. Definitely, that's a fair call, right? But that's not the equation here. The equation here is somebody who already has £800 million is going to have £800 million and £5 or something. That's the difference it makes. If she even gets an extra £5. It probably doesn't. Maybe a pound a copy. That'll be her royalty cut, right? So she's got 800 million and £1, right? That's the difference it makes. It's not going to make any tangible difference whatsoever to her ability to say or do whatever she wants to say or do. And that's the problem with this kind of analysis. It's so wonky. The same person says somewhere down the line, if you're not prepared to stand with us on these small things, then you're obviously not going to be prepared to stand with us on the big things, which is one of the most nonsensical statements I've ever heard. Surely the bigger the issue, the bigger the impact on trans people, the more likely a trans ally is to step up to the plate, not the other way round. You don't start with the small things, the things that don't have any real impact. You start with the things that do have a big impact, don't you? I think, to be fair to the person who wrote this, they were trying to say something else. So what they were trying to say is, well, if you're not prepared to stand with us on the things that don't impact you very much, then you won't stand with us on the things that do impact you very much. But it doesn't make sense, because actually, for some people, this would, if you're a really Harry Potter fan and you've always wanted a game where you could go to Hogwarts and all this kind of thing, this could be like the biggest entertainment product for several years for you. You could have been dying for this ever since you started reading Harry Potter books, watching the films, etc., etc. This might have been the game you've always dreamt of. Whereas some of the things which are big issues for trans people, right, which could have much more impact on their lives than denying J.K. Rowling £1, actually might have very little impact for you. All you might need to do is just, you know, show some affiliation, show some support. So the two things don't scale together in any way, shape or form. But I wanted to talk about allyship. This idea, it says you're not an ally. And this is the problem with allyship. Well, there's two problems with allyship. The first is, it's not allyship. Allyship is a reciprocal relationship. That's what it is. That's what allies are. They are people who come to each other's aid. Two nations that come to each other's aid. If you get attacked, we'll come and back you up. If we get attacked, you come and back us up. What we're talking about when we're talking about these sort of social allies isn't an allyship, firstly, because it's a one-way relationship. You come and defend me, and I... You come and defend me. Right, that's all it means. And it gets quite coercive, because even though the relationship is A, giving allyship to B, A supporting B, you will get some Bs that are very grudging about that and very demanding. And all they're interested in really is just trying to undermine the ally and tell them that they're not doing a good enough job. And start making more demands on what they need to do. They need to step up to the plate and be a bit better ally. There are not many things in the 14 years I've been on YouTube. I don't know whether there's virtually anything other than don't put your head in boiling hot chip fat, where I've given people a direct recommendation. Right. I tend not to do that. If you watch my videos, you'll know that. I tend to just give you my opinion, tell you what I think, right? Tell you where I'm at. I don't say this is what I think you should do. But this is an exception with allyship. Don't identify as an ally ever. Unless you're in sovereign state and there's another sovereign state, right? Okay. That's an exception. But if you're an individual and it's a group you care about, don't identify as an ally. All you're doing is saying, can I please enter into an abusive relationship where I'm going to be on the wrong side of it? Because that's all you're doing. All the positive things you might want to do, you can do anyway. But why not do them on your own terms? Why not do them in such a way that you can draw the line such that you don't have to say things that you don't agree with, such that when maybe that 5% of the time where you think, actually, that's a bit too much, I don't agree with that, you're not going to have somebody saying to you, you need to shut up. If you're an ally, right, what you need to be doing is amplifying our voices and putting forward what we want you to put forward, not to start disagreeing with us, not to start giving a counter narrative or criticizing us, because that is what you will get every single time. There are some people who will start putting that upon you. You're effectively denying yourself the chance to state your own opinions and effectively saying, I'm just going to become a vessel for somebody else's opinions. For sort of, it's almost like joining a political party and joining a government or something like that, where once you do that, once you get into that governmental part, it doesn't really matter what you believe anymore. These are the policies that the government decides upon, and you are supposed to adopt those policies and promote those policies as if you agree with all of them and not start speaking against some of them. And if you do, right, that's really, really frowned upon. And that's exactly what happens with this allyship. I'm not saying everybody in all these groups that people ally themselves with are as abusive of that. Of course they're not. Some people are much more reasonable, much more grateful, much more thankful, and much more accommodating to the fact that the people who are allying with them, supporting them, actually have views of their own and might not agree with their exact points on every single thing. But unfortunately, not everybody is like that. And there will be people who will start to abuse you and start to try and coerce you into not giving your own positions anymore. you can achieve whatever you want to achieve without using the label ally. It's one of the few things online that I get really kind of nasty with. I really bristle on those occasions where people have said, oh, so you call yourself an ally and yet you've said this. I'm like, no. I've never, ever, ever called myself an ally of your cause or any other cause, and I never, ever would. It's just asking to be abused as far as I am concerned. Okay, that's it. I don't make any excuses for the fact that this is a little bit rambling. I knew it would be. I knew the bits that I wanted to cover was sort of a bit from over here, a bit from over there, a bit from over there. But that's the nature of these things, right? So many different things, the confluence of different things all get caught up together in something just as sort of this phenomena of this Hogwarts legacy game before it has even been released. And the way that people are trying to push others into adopting a certain stance. Unless you don't play this game, you're not with us. It's the sort of, you know, the old George W. Bush, if you're not with us, you're against us kind of a thing. And this game, this is where you prove yourself. This is where you can show your virtues, you know. And it's just so manipulative. It's so horribly, nastily manipulative. And yet this is just common currency. This isn't a one-off. This is just the way society seems to be rolling at the moment. There is pushback to it. There is pushback to it amongst people, obviously, who don't hold the same views. Hence why this has astronomical pre-sales. But it also has pushback from people who just don't like that kind of manipulation. And it almost would, like, even I'm not going to play the game, I'm going to buy it anyway now, just as a sort of fuck you, quite honestly. Like I say, I haven't gone down that path. With regard to Hogwarts Legacy, I've seen some trailers. It looks kind of, some of it looks a bit twee, some of it looks kind of exciting. I just like to sort of walk around Hogwarts and the grounds and all that kind of stuff. That's for me just exploring as much as anything. So I probably my expectation is that I will end up buying it, whether I buy it straight away or it's a year later, buying it discounted or whatever. I probably will buy it, but I'm certainly not going to have any concern. It doesn't even matter, like, if J.K. Rowling was Adolf fucking Hitler, right? If Adolf Hitler had £800 million and me buying that game is going to give him £800 million and £1, right? I'm honestly not going to lose a great deal of sleep over that. Okay, that's it. Interested to know what you think. Thank you for watching. Bye for now.